We're talking about women in the workforce here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and there is this metaphor called the leaky pipeline, and it means the process by which women go missing from the talent pool. And these are women who would most likely be tapped for top leadership jobs. Sociologists have looked at this drippy pipe from lots of angles: the earnings gap, the motherhood penalty, the freelance work that sells women short. And the fact is, taking a career break is conflicted and it's risky for women. So for shorthand, it's called opting out, but it's a lot more complex. Want to hear from you. Did you opt out of your career to stay home and raise kids? What was that decision like and where are you now? Join in 800-642-1234. Pamela Stone is a sociology professor at Hunter College and at the City University of New York Graduate Center. She's co-authored the new book called Opting Back In: What Really Happens When Mothers Go Back to Work. And it's a follow-up to her book called Opting Out. Pam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. I'm great to be here.
Well, when sociologists say opting out, how long of a career break are you talking about?
Well, obviously, there's variation. And what I found in my work was that women were out on average about 10 years before they really got back into the sort of their second act. So it turns out that we're talking about pretty privileged women here. They'd formerly had professional careers, married to professionals. And so they're able to sustain a longer time out than the typical woman.
Yeah. And so you had a book in 2007 when these women were opting out of the workforce to raise families. 10 years go by. It must feel like a real cliffhanger for you to really want to follow up and see what happened to these
exactly.
women.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because that was a question that I couldn't answer with the first study. The first study, I'm talking to the women when they're still at home, having made the decision. And the key question was, well, what prompted you to quit? Because these were women who had great careers, you know, had a lot of training and education, seemed to be doing well on the face of it. And, you know, why do you walk away from that? So that book looked in a sense in the causes and of why women made the decision. But I talked to them, of course, about what they were thinking about doing in the future with regard to work and family. Most of them did want to go back. And so that was the kind of, as you say, cliffhanger, because, you know, I wanted to find out, well, were they able to? Did they make good on those intentions?
Why did you decide to focus on women with these Ivy League pedigrees, with these very high achieving and privileged backgrounds?
Because I was really interested in women who should be positioned, who were positioned by virtue of their education and training for leadership. I was also interested in women who had demonstrated that they had could compete in a competitive, you know, in a competitive environment. So I was looking for women who were scholastic, you know, had shown themselves to be good at, you know, academically, so that we couldn't say, well, they're just quitting because they couldn't cut it, or they're quitting because they're not good enough. I wanted to look at women who would otherwise be, as I said, positioned for leadership, but of course weren't.
What are the numbers out there? What percentage of women in the workforce are doing this, are opting out?
Well, it's not as large percent at any one time as people think. In other words, oftentimes people, this phenomenon seems to gather a good bit of visibility, and I think people think it's a bigger phenomenon than it is. And
oh, the media portray it that way.
Yes, right. I mean, it gets a lot of media attention. And we are talking, when I talk about opting out, I'm talking about really middle, you know, educated women. When a retail clerk at Walgreens quits a job, that's not opting out. That's, you know, that's just taking some time out. It's, you know, it's a very different phenomenon. I think opting out, when you look at the media portrayal, is very much focused on these elite women. But to get back to your question, you know, at any point in time, talking about college-educated women, about 80% of women are at work. 80% of college-educated mothers are at work. So, and they have very high rates of labor force participation. But because we're talking about women who have professional careers, where interruption is so costly because it's really expected that you're going to work continuously and accrue experience and knowledge as you do so, any break is really significant. And when you look across women's, you know, kind of the span of their career, not just at one point in time, it's about 30 to 40% who take some kind of a career break. So, for example, I was involved in a study of Harvard MBA students, male and female, and we found out that virtually none of the men take a break, of course. But even this group, you know, who you can pretty well assume are highly ambitious, highly successful, et cetera, about 30% over the course of their work lives took a significant break of a year or more. So, the significance is over the course of their working lives that the break is taken.
We're talking about why women leave the workforce and the process by which they reenter. Talking with sociologist Pam Stone, she studies women in the workforce, and she looks at why women opt out and opt back in. Did you opt out and then go back to work later? How did you weigh returning to the workforce? Did you wait until your children were old enough to go to school? How did you land on the decision? Join in with your story, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Pam, the research shows that college-educated women, they start out and stay equal with their male counterparts in their 20s, and that starts changing. And you can trace that change in their 30s and 40s through motherhood. What happens there when they start out equal and things change?
Yeah. Well, you know, we know, even though the gender per se is in terms of its impact on earnings, has that effect has kind of not gone away, but it's definitely abated over time. The motherhood penalty, interestingly enough, in other words, whether all things being equal, if you're a mom, you make less than a woman who's not a mom. That penalty has also, believe it or not, slightly declined over time. But what hasn't declined over time is the penalty to experience. And so to the extent then that women are dropping out or taking time out of the labor force, they're not accruing experience. And that, especially among professional jobs, takes a real hit. So that accounts for about a third of the earnings gap nowadays, the fact that women have less experience, are likely to work fewer hours than male counterparts. So that's become a very significant piece of the puzzle in understanding the gender gap in earnings.
Why do you see the motherhood penalty dissolving a little bit, easing there?
Well, you know, this tends to be out of quantitative research, and just seeing that the effect is a little bit less, you know, the ding is a little less bad than it used to be. But I think that to some extent, you know, whether it's a social phenomenon that people are getting more used to women working moms in the workforce. So there's a bit of that. But it's still a significant penalty. I don't want to tell you it's not there, but it's just not as big as it used to be. But I think there's some amount of the workforce making some accommodation and not being quite as penalizing as it used to be. Women, as I said, working moms and college-educated ones have very high rates of labor force participation. So you'd be talking about, you know, wiping out a pretty significant group of people. So over time, I think there's a little bit, you know, it's not that there's no catching up at all to changes that have been taking place in women's working profile. It's just that there's usually a big lag.
Did these women you talked with, these 43 women, take you into the conversations they had with their spouses about this opting out and about this decade that was going by?
Yeah.
Was there tension?
Well, interestingly enough, no. Not least in the decision to first take time out. I talk quite a lot about that, actually, in the first book. Women, to a woman, everyone said, "My husband is supportive. My husband is supportive. My husband is supportive." But what that turned out to mean is that the husband basically gave them permission to quit. The husband, or maybe in one or two cases, said, "Well, you know, maybe I'll quit instead of you. You know, maybe I'll step back and take some time out." No, it was always about, "Honey, you do whatever you want to do. I'll support you." So women were left to struggle with this basically on their own, this decision. And they were just as they were left to struggle with the whole work family conundrum on their own. So the initial decision to opt out was supported by men, but not you know, in a way that I would call significant support.
We're going to pause right there with Pam Stone. The book is called Opting Back In, and she stays with us. Did you rise through the ranks in your field but exited to focus on raising your family? Did you downshift, as they say, cut back on your hours or move to a lesser position in exchange for work-life balance? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue this in a moment here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about what happens when women take a career break, opting out of the workforce, as they say. We're tracing the decisions and the outcomes of 43 elite women who stepped away from their professions and they spent a decade at home raising kids. What are the gains and losses for women who decide to opt out and then restart their careers later on? Did you take a work hiatus? Did it feel risky? Did you feel you had a choice? When you applied for jobs, how did you explain that employment gap? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Sociologist Pam Stone stays with us. She's co-author of the new book. It's called Opting Back In. Pam, you were talking there about spouses and the prevailing narrative has long suggested women opt out because it's what they prefer. But the women you talked with never intended to devote themselves to raising a family. Did you find that their husbands experienced a similar kind of pressure to balance that career and family?
No. The husbands tended to really defer to their wives. The husbands had high, intense jobs, just, you know, long hour, highly intense jobs, just the way their wives did. These were, you know, more and more couples are married, their marriages of equals. So the husbands certainly picked up the kinds of things husbands do, but they, in terms of taking care of the kids on weekends and things like that, but the husbands were very much secondary in terms of their involvement with the work and family. And one of the things I was going to mention, and when the women wanted to go back, in other words, having been out, the attitude of husbands actually changed a bit. So whereas before they'd been kind of passive bystanders, supportive, quietly supporting their wives in whatever decision she wanted to make, by the time it came, you know, to the decision to return to work, husbands at that point had kind of gotten used to having their wives at home. So it wasn't to a man, but most of them tended to sort of like what had happened. And they didn't want to tell the women to end their careers. But once women had ended their careers, husbands found it really helped them. It made life a lot simpler. It made women could actually help the men leverage their careers, do better in their careers, spend even more time at work, frankly. When it came back to opting back in, the husbands were more ambivalent than they had been with the initial decision to opt out.
What about that more time at work? What did these women find about the hours and then trying to also run a family at home?
Right. That was the single, you know, my book actually has a question mark in the title, Opting Out, because it's so much not about opting out in terms of, again, the way it's typically been portrayed, that this is a woman making a sort of major preference shift in favor of home and hearth. That's not what happened. As you were saying at the opening there, these are women who would say to me over and over again, I can't believe I'm having this interview with you. I never, ever thought that I would be at home full time. These were women who really expected to have careers, but as is so typical of women of their sort of ability and background, the kinds of jobs that they are recruited into are very extreme hour, we call them extreme hour type jobs, you know, management, consulting, finance, media, industries that are very, very demanding and work where you work routinely 50, 60, 70 hours a week. So that even if you have a little bit of flexibility and control, it's, you know, just do the math and the hours basically squeeze out any kind of time you can have with your family. So it was really the women having to try to get out from under these long hour jobs that was the problem. And when they did that, because these were valued, you know, employees, they would typically be able to broker some kind of a, again, typically private arrangement with their boss, oftentimes hush hush. And those kinds of arrangements were ultimately in these kind of high intense work environments were ultimately doomed to failure. And that's what happened. So that part-time hours would creep up to full-time hours, but without the pay. Women would find that meaningful assignments were being taken away from them once they went part-time.
Or 80% was really in no way 80%.
Exactly, exactly. And no, that's exactly what happened. And they would actually feel, we'd call it flex stigma. I mean, they would really feel like they were letting down the side, that the people that, you know, where they were perceived as not being team players, as not being committed. And all of those forces together was what would propel them out. As one woman said to me, she said, you know, I was a nobody working part-time, but I was nobody at home, but I'd be a nobody working part-time. So which nobody did I want to be? I mean, they just felt that there was no reason for them to continue working under those conditions. So that's what propelled them out initially.
We're talking about why women leave the workforce and the process by which they re-enter. Pam Stone is a sociologist at Hunter College, and she looks at gender inequality in employment and job segregation. Did you stay home to raise kids? Why did you feel it was your responsibility rather than your partner's to assume this role as caretaker? Are you still deciding whether you should return to work, and what's that process like? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Pam, let's get into some of the people whose lives that you have infiltrated here. One woman is Nan Driscoll, who was the editor-in-chief for a book packaging firm. And she told you, as she had stepped away from that, she told you about the pressures around kids getting good grades, being in clubs. How do these types of parenting pressures affect how women prioritize their careers?
Well, they definitely did affect it. I mean, there's no question that, you know, we call it intensive parenting. It'll probably be a very familiar concept to a lot of listeners out there. You know, that upper middle class parenting, there's a lot of preparing children to assume the mantle of upper middle classdom as when they move on to adulthood. And so the pressures weigh very heavily on all these women, and they do tend to weigh heavily on the women. The men are largely missing in action in these things. The issues of sort of transmission of values, making sure the kids are performing well in school, doing a requisite, you know, set of extracurricular activities, all of that is managed and arranged by women. And this is true across the board, whether you're talking about middle class, upper middle class, you know, working class parents. Women take that managerial role on always. So these things, it's just that when you're an upper middle class mom, you have the resources, you're managing more of them, you know, because you have your kids involved and engaged in many more activities. It's a much more structured kind of childhood.
And these women in this process, as they've stepped back, they go through a transformation in a sense. Many of these women suddenly are really akin to volunteer work. They mm-hmm. see more of an altruistic approach to society and maybe not so much of the corporate arena. What happens to their tendencies when they look to go back to work?
Yes, no, that's a very good point. That was one of the most interesting things was, you know, these were women who, again, by virtue of who they were, high-achieving women, were channeled into primarily male-dominated lines of work because that's where the money and the prestige is, right? And those were the opportunities that had been closed to women in the past. So we've high-achieving women flock to those, understandably. But when they get home, they're exposed to a very different world because, remember, their kids are school-age, most of them. And so they're seeing teachers, they're seeing a whole different world at work that they had never thought about before. And they definitely, one of the big things they do is they really throw themselves into volunteer work. Remember, they're pretty resentful that they're home. There's a huge adjustment being home for them. And one of the ways they feel they can sort of deploy some of their skills or work skills is through volunteer work, for example. So they volunteer at very high levels. So this gives them what we call the sort of the whole world of care, you know, unpaid labor. Yeah, it gives them an advantage point and a perspective on that world that was really invisible to them before. And they come to appreciate it. You know, they come to appreciate these values and they come to appreciate the contributions that, you know, teachers are making, for example. And so that really does figure in to sort of what's happening as they're thinking about what am I going to do about going back to work? Because they leave work intending to go back to work. I mean, these are women who, by and large, you know, expect that they're going to be going back to work. It takes them a lot longer, in part, because there's this period of change where they're really ending up rethinking what they were doing before, both attracted to some of the things they're seeing, as we were just describing, you know, in the new world of work, or the new volunteer world and school world, but also because of the negative feelings of having really been shut out of their former careers.
And they very rarely go back to their former employer, as you found.
Virtually never. I mean, I think that's one of the things that's so interesting is, you know, you think they're going to go back to their former employers. They really had quite negative experiences with those employers. You know, I described them already. They feel that, you know, that oftentimes that they had been high performers. They had put together very viable, in their minds, job sharing or part-time programs. Are very responsible. They're getting work done, and their efforts are failing, and they feel very unsupported. by those former employers. And one woman said to me, she said, it took me about 3 minutes to decide I was never going back. And that was really, she articulated what was so true for so many of the women. They just put those former worlds behind them.
Mm. We're understanding the complexities of combining work and family and the choices made by women who put their decisions under the microscope for a pair of sociologists who are trying to parse gender norms and society. Pam Stone is one of those sociologists. She's our guide. She's co-author of the book called Opting Back In. And let's hear from you. There's a line for you. Do you regret leaving your job, or was it the best decision you made? Maybe you didn't have a choice. You left your career because childcare was too expensive, or you had an aging parent to care for. How did you take on the role of caretaker? Join through the hour, 800-642-1234. You can email your story ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue this conversation with Pam Stone, maybe hear from you right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And by the way, it's totally worth checking out a new podcast from WPR News. It's called Derailed. Episode 1 is out today. And this is a story of how high-speed rail almost came to Wisconsin, and we learn the politics behind that. New episodes drop every Wednesday. You can find Derailed wherever you get your podcasts and at WPR.org. Right now, we're talking about women moving in and out of the workforce. The question is, can professional women return to work after a timeout for motherhood? What are the trade-offs? What are the consequences to their professional lives? The shorthand terms that come up a lot in this discussion are opting in, opting out. Your stories are welcome here. Have you opted out to focus on raising kids? Are you still deciding whether to return to work? How do you start, starting a family, how did that change your earning potential? Join in at 800-642-1234. Hunter College sociology professor Pam Stone is here. Her book is called Opting Back In, What Really Happens When Mothers Go Back to Work. Let's go to the phones now. Kate is joining us from Neenah. Hi, Kate.
Good morning.
Good morning. What is your story?
I had a similar experience to this author's book, and I'm anxious to read it and compare. I worked for 12 years out of college and was pleased and satisfied with my progress and my career path, but I found it to be just very difficult in terms of balancing the work-life balance, and I chose to opt out, and I wound up staying out for 12 years. While the kids were in elementary school and junior high, and ultimately went back to work in an entirely different field. And now I'm about 8 years into that second career, and it's very different. It's very rewarding. And I still couldn't be happier with my decision. So even, with the less money from two working parents to all of the decisions that we made to prioritize the kids when they were little, it just worked out incredibly well.
Okay, thank you so much for your story. May I ask what your second career was? Is?
Yes, it is. My second career is in higher education. And while I was out focusing on raising the kids, I had an opportunity to get back and go to graduate school. And I also became a local elected official for a time. And I just realized that I really liked nonprofit or public sector work better for the sense of reward that it brings. So when I went back, my second child was a senior in high school, so we were getting ready for two college tuitions. And I just really started looking for like a mission-based work. I wanted something entirely different than what I had left. And as it turns out, it has just been just exceptionally positive and very, very rewarding.
Well, let's bring Pam Stone in here. It sounds like Kate just leaps off your pages.
She just leaps off my pages. It's quite remarkable, actually. She does, absolutely. And I think that mission-based thing, it's, I hadn't talked about that, but that is something that I see very much. We see very much from the women we studied as well. You know, we actually know that this is part of the aging process. Sorry, Kate, but we're all getting older here, right? So part of, we know this, as people get older, they start looking for more mission-based work. But for us, we think it's also what I was talking about earlier. It's so much that, you know, that you're seeing a world, you know, these women like Kate is seeing a world she hasn't been exposed to before. And it's really eye-opening, right? It's the world of volunteer work, community service, that kind of thing. So, yeah, that these are real attractions for the women that we study as well, just really exactly as Kate described. We heard that over and over again. And also we heard how satisfied women were with the changes that they had made, even though, and again, similar, it was meant that there was a fairly long time out while women figured out what it was they wanted to do, as Kate did, oftentimes going back to school to get, you know, additional training in order to change careers. We had a number of women, that woman you mentioned earlier, Nan Driscoll, who had been the editor, she became a teacher. Actually, she became a teacher's aide. Regrettably, she had a hard time finding the teaching job she would have liked. But, you know, she went back to school to become a teacher. So this was very, very common. And it's on the one hand, it's an extremely exciting thing to see that women can reinvent like this. But I also, you know, as you know from the book, I will preview, we do sound a caution about this because from our point of view, you know, you have to think, why are we asking women to reinvent this way? You know, the burden of that being entirely on them. You know, why is it necessary that women have to leave careers in which they've made a lot of investments in training and have been very successful, actually, their first careers? Why are we making them leave those and start anew? And I think that's a question we have, that, you know, it's working for individual women, but there's a larger social question. What are the costs, economic and social, when we ask women to start over like this?
Yeah, and, you know, these are highly individual decisions or extremely personal decisions, mm-hmm. but they add up when you look across the workforce.
Right.
How do these decisions play a broader role in the social patterns you're seeing in gender inequality?
Right. Well, so one of the things we talk about in gender inequality, for example, is we talk about integration of formerly male-dominated occupations. And what you see happening in the course of the arc of these women's lifetime is they go from being in male-dominated fields to more female-dominated fields. So, for example, in my study, the women in our study, initially about just under half of all the women were in male-dominated jobs. By the time they re-enter and go back to work, only about a quarter are. So that's actually halved. And instead, women are, you know, the number, the percentage of women in female-dominated jobs is going way up. I mean, on the one hand, that's great, but again, we look at integration of male-dominated occupations by women as a measure of progress. And if you buy that premise, what's happening, of course, is that women are, in a sense, going backwards. They're resegregating over the life course, right? They're going from more male-dominated or integrated jobs into more female-dominated jobs, which was the old female ghetto, we used to call it. So that's one thing. Obviously, with regard to leadership, where it's clearly very important that you have a good bit of experience and continuity of employment to ascend to leadership positions, when women start over in a new profession, a new occupation, they start over in the leadership track, and they start over, obviously, at a much older age. So their ability to ascend and to attain leadership is obviously compromised. And then finally, they're moving into jobs because, regrettably, female-dominated jobs are paid less, just because women do them, frankly, than male-dominated jobs. They're taking a big earnings hit as well. So interestingly enough, you know, over the course of these women's lives, making decisions that make a lot of sense for them. This is not a criticism of those decisions. The decisions they're making make a lot of sense. But when you step back, what's happening is they're creating greater gender inequality. They're channeling women back into lower paying female dominated jobs. And that's, you know, the cost, the larger social cost and economic cost to us as a society of not making their original professions more family friendly.
We're talking with Pam Stone. She's a sociologist at Hunter College, and she studies women in the workforce. You can join in. How do you think starting a family changed your earning potential? Where do you see a fix here for the gender pay gap across all class levels? Is it more affordable childcare? Is it restructuring of social norms, more parity in the workplace? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Pam, a listener shared over email that she's been away from a law practice for over a dozen years, and she feels ready for a new career. And she's asking, is it unusual for women in her position to return to school? Is she's considering a technical degree in a lower-paying, high-demand job. What about that, she asks?
No, it's not unusual. And because women are concerned that they won't be able to get back into their former professions, often that's another impetus to change entirely. So, you know, she can tool up again in law. She can, you know, take refresher courses. Law is a field. I actually could have done an entire study on nothing but lawyers. There's a lot of women who are moving out of law, you know, just the way we described. And so the profession is aware of that. And so there are increasingly organizations that will help women get back into law and help them relaunch their careers in law if she wants to go back into law, for example.
You talked with a lawyer who wanted a real change and to move up in the publishing world, but found that in order to do that, you really needed to be younger. You needed to be work and pay your dues. And, you know, she didn't have time for that. She wasn't really young. What about ageism? What do you see?
Yeah. Well, you know, obviously the women that I see are successful at getting back in. So they're certainly worried about the ageism, and ageism is very real. So I don't think we can dismiss ageism. Again, these women were, because they started over and were willing to start over, I think they demonstrated to prospective employers that they could deal with, you know, starting over. And that some of the concern about ageism is employers are concerned that older workers just won't be able to fit in at a more junior rank because they're not used to that, right? Well, these were women who had shown that they could do that. So I think they were able to negate some of the ageism from that point of view. And also they had very marketable skills by the time they'd retooled, for example.
But it's
definitely a concern, yeah.
Was there a skills gap, though? Sitting out, were their skills getting rusty or not up to date? Was that an issue?
Yes, absolutely. And that's why so many of them basically started over. That's in part a reason they could start over. It's not why they started over, but that's why so many of them did start over, to basically address that issue. In other words, just as your emailer was saying, look, I've been in law, but I'm rusty in law. I think I'm going to start something else. That was the same thing that many women had. But they also were moved to new professions for other reasons that we were talking about earlier. But they really did take the burden of retraining on themselves just to avoid these issues of obsolete skills, which is part of the ageism, you know, package, so to speak.
Talking with sociologist Pam Stone, she writes, women who've opted out of the workforce typically opt back in, although the path back to work is littered with dead ends and start overs. If you took a career break, what motivated you to return to your profession? What kind of reception did you get as you sought out a new opportunity after a break? How did you work out new arrangements with your partner at home? How did you divvy up responsibilities? Do you feel home life decisions are equitable? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for a conversation about women in the workforce here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We're talking about what happens to elite women who opt out of the workforce to raise a family, and that takes them off of the leadership track in their former fields. And these are deeply personal, individual decisions set against this backdrop of much larger societal issues. Current estimates say the pay gap won't close until 2058. Women won't reach gender parity in leadership until 2085. So where does this leave things? What choices have you made in your life that could impact the pay gap or the leadership gap? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Sociologist Pam Stone's book is called Opting Back In. Pam, let's look at some policy things that might address this, you know, what we can do next. You say that the mismatch between the needs of working women and their workplaces is a major social dilemma. So, you know, what are the solutions out there? What could work?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we advocate, you know, quite strongly that employers, if they're really serious about, retaining women and moving women up through the leadership ranks, that they have to understand that there's, you know, we've got to think about new ways to work. And in particular, we have to attack this incredible long-hour culture, which is really devastating for women and a real driver of inequality. And besides which, all the research shows it's not optimally productive for employers. It's unhealthy for all workers. It has huge, huge downsides. So we're kind of saying, let's stop ignoring all that research and let's think about ways we can implement, you know, really meaningful flexibility and cut down on hours and up productivity, retain women at the same time. So we hope that that's the kind of thing that employers would want to do out of their own self-interests. They haven't shown as much inclination to that as we'd like. But, for example, just recently, when the labor market starts getting tight, there's an article recently in the Times, you know, employers are more open to experimenting with these kinds of things and hopefully find ways to, you know, experiment with them and that make them more viable than they have been in the past. But that's one thing. And, I mean, you know, if you look to a European model, there are a lot of laws regulating work time and permissible work hours. Now, you know, I don't think that's a model that in the United States would be very amenable to, but, you know, ultimately you can think about how you can regulate wages and hours so that, you know, these extraordinary hours are prohibited. But we'd like to think that employers would do it out of enlightened self-interest.
I'm thinking about what's changed in this decade since these women you talked with, these 43 women, opted out. And look, just looking at technology and how many more people work remotely and yet also have to be tethered to their devices and Slack and email. Mm-hmm. You know, the technology in itself has changed so much.
That's right. And that's actually one of the things, because it has been a time of especially rapid technological change on the work front. And that's, of course, one of the things that's hard for – that's where women have to really tool up when they think about going back. That's one of the things that's most daunting to them. You're absolutely right about that. But those things – like anything else, they can cut both ways. You can be tethered, as you say, all the time. But they also do allow new ways to work. And one of the things we're seeing is, you know, younger up-and-coming workers are starting to ask for the same kind of thing that basically the women are asking for. They want much more flexibility in their work. They don't want to be tied to long hours and chained to a desk. So, you know, hopefully the impetus for change is coming not just from women, but from, you know, from younger workers, male and female. I did want to mention, by the way, Kate, because I don't want to let this go. Another way that women got back in that was quite popular was, of course, freelancing. And that meant that they stayed with their former knowledge set, and they drew on that. You know, so becoming obsolete wasn't as big an issue for those women, obviously, because they picked up the consulting, and they tended to go into that more quickly than, not surprisingly, than the women who reinvented totally. So
offered them more flexibility. They could also be their own boss.
Right, exactly. And so that was a very popular way back, too. Not as popular as the other, but quite popular. And, you know, it has the downsides, you know. Gig economy employment is unpredictable. It's not as secure. You're taking yourself off leadership track. So there's a downside, but it did work for these women. That was another strategy I wanted to mention.
Yeah, and so class and gender differences can influence, you know, deciding who should parent and who should be making the money, so to speak. But you say parenting is still universally considered the woman's role. How might family leave policies help change that view?
Yeah. Well, you know, they have things in places like Sweden where the men are required to take a certain amount of family leave. And they've seen a really radical change in the extent to which fathers are fathering and parenting. It's become, you know, the men evidently who don't take the parental leave are looked down upon. So, you know, these kind of changes, you know, can actually change behavior and change attitudes quite profoundly. You know, when you define something as like sexual harassment as illegal, you know, it becomes prohibitive. Attitudes around it change to behavior that was formerly tolerated, for example. So putting in, you know, getting paid parental leave, it's so important not only providing a benefit, but in legitimating the concept, right? And that becomes really, really important. It gives men permission to father, because there's every reason to believe that fathers want to father and do more parenting. You know, it's just that, again, especially in the couples that I was studying, they work even longer hours than their wives do. I mean, that's they're both in these, you know, these high demand jobs. I think it's the legitimating function of things like paid parental leave. And obviously for the kind of couples that I studied, virtually all of them had the company pay had gave them paid parental leave. When you work at these very elite firms, you get a great benefits package. So something like paid parental leave is going to be, you know, incredibly important for most workers who don't have access to companies that provide paid parental leave. So I think that'll make a big difference. But I will add that what's important too, especially for women, is that it's not just give women leave, help them reintegrate back into the workforce. And that's sometimes a difficult – that was sometimes a sticking point, that women would come back, you know, to the new old firms as mothers, and the company didn't know what to do with them, frankly. So we need to make sure that we reintegrate, especially moms, back into the workforce because, again, we have breastfeeding issues. There's so many, you know, other sort of physical demands that women are dealing with and men don't have to deal with.
Talking with Pam Stone, a sociology professor at Hunter College, and her new book is called Opting Back In. It's a follow-up from her book a dozen years ago called Opting Out. Still time for your story, 800-642-1234. Pam, where are we with the pay gap? Just another obstacle there on this, you know, journey to parity between men and women. What about the gap in pay?
Well, it's, you know, this is another one that, you know, we made some rapid progress in the 70s and then started stalling out in the 80s. And we pretty much stayed put at around 80%, women earning 78 to 80 cents on the dollar for every, you know, dollar earned by men. And it's just not been budging very much. And so, you know, one of the things, you know, you hear about pay equity, for example, that's receiving a new push because, you know, the fact that, for example, the women that I study who decide to become teachers after being big executives take this huge cut in pay. You know, what if we were paying teachers fairly, we would pay teachers a lot more, so there wouldn't be such a huge penalty to being in a female-dominated occupation, for example. So that would go a long way, you know, raising the pay that many researchers feel is unfairly low because women are the predominant workers in those occupations. So raising the pay of female-dominated occupations through pay equity policies is extremely important. Some of this new stuff that's coming out where employers cannot ask about experience and cannot ask you what you made in your last job because obviously women make less money and that perpetuates wage inequality. So I think that this is one of those exciting things that we're seeing right now that there's much more attention being paid to this. So we haven't seen the movement yet, but we see some sort of things starting to happen that might bode well for seeing some closure of the gap.
Well, you're calling for a movement, though. You kind of want to see more of this Me Too movement around this issue and get women who have opted out to start speaking up. How does that work?
Well, you know, the great thing about Me Too is it's sort of like, wait a minute, I thought this was just me, but this has been happening to everybody, right? And I think just your caller who called in and whose experience was exactly like the women in my book, right? I think what we need to have a greater awareness of, it's not just me. It's not just that I'm overwhelmed by my work-family conflict that I have. A lot of things women would say to me, I'm a perfectionist. It's just me. I'm a perfectionist. No, it's not just you. And I think what could make so much headway for sort of equality and allowing women to pursue work and family simultaneously, which is what they want to do and have to do, if we could make work more humane. And that's, again, I tend to focus, especially from my research, on hours. So, you know, I'd like to see women, you know, thinking much more about making demands on this front and realizing what a barrier it is to women's success generally. And so, you know, that on that front as well as other fronts, you know, I think women, especially privileged women, have a role they can play to
Pam, help thank move you so much forward. For joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Kate. It was a great, great hour. I really enjoyed it.
Pam Stone, sociology professor at Hunter College. Her new book is called Opting Back In. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Ideas Network.